This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Well, welcome everyone to episode 42 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Mike Morrison, and with me as always is Zachary Frühling. Today we're going to be talking about a new book that's coming out by author Kevin C. Nease called The Gospel According to Star Trek, The Original Crew. Zachary, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Mike. First of all, I can't believe it's episode 42. I'm not sure if our listeners are going to get the answer to the ultimate question of life, the universe, and everything on this episode of Metatrex, but we're going to give it the old college try. But I'm excited to be joined by Kevin Nease today. You and I have dabbled into the realm of theology and philosophy of religion on Metatrex a few times. It's not something we've spent a lot of time on. There's some overlap between philosophy and theology, so I'm excited to dive in and talk about the relationship between Star Trek and Christian theology here with Kevin today.
Well, Zachary, I just received a hail from the USS Undiscovered Country. They have Kevin Nease ready to beam aboard the USS Theseus. So let me boost my pattern stream. Here we go. And Kevin, welcome aboard.
Thank you for having me aboard. It's nice to be here, sir.
Well, for those of you who may not be familiar with Kevin C. Nease, Kevin C. Nease is an author and speaker on media, the arts, and pulp culture from a Christian worldview perspective. He is a former professor. Kevin holds a BAS in communication and philosophy and an MLA in fine arts. Lives with his wife and son nearby, right across the way from me in Fort Worth, Texas. Kevin, we are so glad to have you aboard, and we're looking forward to talking about your new book that's just been released, The Gospel According to Star Trek, The Original Crew, and we want to talk a little bit about your background and your relationship with Star Trek. So again, we're glad to have you aboard the USS Theseus and here on Metatrex today.
I'm glad to be here, sir. I didn't expect the ship to be this decked out, but it's pretty impressive, I gotta say.
It's only the best.
The plasma screens are a nice touch. That's all I'm saying. The carpet's excellent.
only the best on the Starship Theseus.
Good.
Well, Kevin, we want to dive right in and talk a little bit again about your history and relationship with Star Trek, because as someone who is, I'm also a theologian, and there's not always a great love affair between Star Trek and theology. And so I have found that it's very, very difficult to have those conversations where you're discussing Star Trek from a Christian worldview. So that's something that I think you and I probably have in common, but it's not a common thing.
No, it's not a common thing. And that's one of the reasons that I've done this, is because I want to help people see what I've seen, basically. I want to share what I've found, because I do see there's kind of this community of people who are examining pop culture, and particularly nerdy stuff, sci-fi, etc., from a Christian worldview perspective. There's guys with the Sci-Fi Christian, there's the Christian Nerd, and there's Geeklessia, and all kinds of different people out there who are having these kinds of conversations. And through the Undiscovered Country Project, I've been able to network with those people. But it's really interesting, because a lot of people, especially Christian people, well, no, let me say that properly. A lot of Christian people when they look at Star Trek, they have that same idea that, well, this is a place where theology doesn't belong, doesn't apply, or where the worldview that's driving this is opposed to my worldview, you know, because it is humanistic. And so therefore they see Star Trek as something that either they feel guilty for liking or they reject outright. And my experience is a lot different from that.
I think in general, one of the things that's hardest in philosophy or theology is creating coherent worldview. I think a lot of us don't pay a lot of attention to the sources of the things that inform our worldview. We have, you know, inherent tensions in our worldview. That, if you like certain facets of the ethics of Star Trek, but you have a Christian metaphysics and a Christian religious practice, trying to incorporate and unify different, you know, sort of competing belief systems into something that's a coherent whole is a challenge for any belief system, I think. So I'm anxious to hear sort of your evolution of, your earliest days and your earliest memories watching Star Trek, how it informed your Christian worldview or has how it's competed with your Christian worldview, and how you've tried to unify those into something that is somewhat coherent. And I should say too, Kevin, I had a chance to read an early draft of your book, and I was impressed at the way in which you were able to avoid some of the common traps of these kinds of discussions. One of the traps would be trying to read, the connections you find between Star Trek and your own worldview into the original intentions of the creators of that content. And that's a common sort of hermeneutical trap. You wouldn't want to say, because I find these connections and I find this meaning rich, that is part of the original intention. Sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. You don't always know which. And it being conscious of the fact that this discussion is inherently a hermeneutics rich discussion where, the goal is not necessarily to, uncover some hidden meaning inherent in the content you're analyzing, but trying to find the intersections of your own beliefs and your own worldview with the original content and with those original intentions. It's something a little bit more like a Venn diagram, where can you find those points of intersection rather than trying to uncover. And so I just, from the beginning, I would say, if you're listening to this discussion for the first time and used to us talking about more philosophy proper rather than theology, what we're trying to do is trying to claim that Gene Roddenberry was trying to incorporate a Christian worldview into Star Trek. That's exact opposite of what we'd be saying. So I like that you were able to avoid the common trappings in that kind of discussion, Kevin.
Well, thanks very much. That's actually something I've worked very hard at, because it's very important to me to communicate that clearly to people. Because when I come out and say, the gospel according to Star Trek, when I've shared that on Facebook and things, they're always, not always, but very, very often, immediately somebody will come in and try to call me on it and say, you're trying to, use Star Trek to recruit people into your religion, or you're trying to shoehorn your religion into Star Trek, or you can't possibly find anything there because of XYZ thing that they believe about the foundations of Star Trek. And what's really interesting to me is that, you talk about the Venn diagram and everything, and that the things that I find in it are not necessarily intentional. But I am looking at things that are intentional. And to me, even though, like, when I talk about Spock as a Christ figure and things like that, okay, yeah, nobody planned that, which is one of the things that makes it really exciting and fascinating.
And it's one of the more clear connections, I think, is what's counterintuitive.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's the most amazing thing. That's one of those things that just reached out and grabbed me and surprised me. And that's what kind of started me on this whole journey, is the kinds of things that reached out and grabbed me and surprised me. But I'm also talking about what Star Trek is intentional about, which is its humanism, which sends most modern evangelicals and a lot of other conservative Christians running for the hills. But what I argue for is that there's actually a very strong historic tradition of Christian humanism. People that your average evangelical who will say they hate humanism will quote C.S. Lewis or G.K. Chesterton or Augustine, at the drop of a hat, not realizing that all of those people are Christian humanists.
Well, I think you can give a fairly straightforward theological argument for that Christian humanism. I mean, it's basically, in my mind, as simple as, if you believe that mankind is created in the image of God with all of his creative powers, then that humanistic creativity is something that is in the image of God as a creator. So I think that's a fairly straightforward straightforward theological argument that's ignored in a lot of that kind of that popular discussion about humanism.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, when I was starting this journey, I founded this thing. We'll talk about it more later. I found this thing called the Undiscovered Country Project. And one of the reasons I picked that name was because I wanted to help Christians. A lot of my project is, what can Christians learn from Star Trek? That's kind of a big question that I sort of put, if I had it on my office wall, I mean, I could, but, you know, it's one of my kind of banner phrases for the books. And one of the things that struck me early on was I wanted to help rescue the Christian perception of humanity, the Christian value of humanity. And because we're so focused, particularly in the evangelical world, on how fallen and how broken humankind is, because we need that. We need to emphasize that to talk about salvation, which is fine. You know, we need to acknowledge our brokenness, and Star Trek actually does that really well.
Yes.
But we actually spend so much time denigrating our humanity and vilifying it, that I think if there is an undiscovered country in contemporary Christianity, it is perhaps our own humanity. So that's one of the reasons that I...
You know, I think there's an inherent dignity in the Christian worldview of humanity. You know, everything you've said about mankind's fallenness in the Christian worldview, I think is true if that's your worldview. But it's easy to forget that there's a dignity that goes along with it. Being made in the image of God carries a kind of, I don't want to say nobility. It's not quite the right word.
I
think that's an excellent word. There is, Zachary, there is a nobility in the idea that we were created by God in his image.
Yeah.
And I think Star Trek does an exceptional job of capturing the dignity of mankind, maybe not as a creation, but as a creature, right? So as a type of being that has a moral character, I think if it's very easy to sort of read Star Trek as having kind of a plural, almost an overly pluralistic, overly relativistic worldview. But if you really, it's very easy to go looking inside almost episode by episode and find that, you know, that Star Trek is laden with morality. And sometimes the morality you see in any particular episode will conflict with, you know, the characterization of that morality you'd get in another episode. So it's not like there aren't tensions inside. I don't think you can give a coherent account of morality in Star Trek necessarily, but definitely there's a moral character and a moral center to the characters that are especially in Starfleet and the Federation and whatnot. They're not morally void characters, and there's a dignity that goes along with those characters that is, I think, perfectly in line with the dignity of mankind on a Christian worldview.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really ultimately Star Trek at its best features those things. I just finished a book with a buddy of mine called Mark Boone, called Science Fiction and the Abolition of Man, Finding C.S. Lewis in Sci-Fi Films and Television. And it's an essay collection. We use the structure of C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man to have a conversation with multiple voices from multiple parts of sci-fi, film, and television. Star Trek's in there. I'm in there. Well, if I'm in there, Star Trek's in there. That's kind of a good point. But a lot of what we do in that is discuss the relationship between humankind and technology. And that's really important to me when it comes to Star Trek. And of course, it's really important to me when it comes to the Christian worldview as well, because technology is so much a part of who we are. You were saying earlier about our creative impulses reflecting our creator. That's very true. It's something I say in the book, we are created to be creators. That's maybe the primary way. I mean, you might be able to sing out love as the most important way, but probably the thing that separates us from the rest of the animals on the planet, the thing that most closely reflects God is our creativity. But that's expressed through our technology. And so a lot of people kind of see Star Trek as salvation through technology, that humankind will save itself through technology. And yes, a lot of the things in terms of eradicating diseases and ending wars and all this sort of stuff, a lot of that has to do with technology in Star Trek, because we got rid of famine, because we invented replicators, you know, that sort of thing. But it's not about the technology. In fact, there are certain episodes of Star Trek that feel technophobic. Just look at something like the Ultimate Computer, where the M5 computer is taking over the Enterprise, and it's humanizing the Enterprise. And look at the, I mean, this is the next book, the next, or two of the next books, but look at the Borg, you know, this technology overrunning humanity. So really, the thing that is most important in Star Trek is not our technology. Our technology is a tool that we use, and it's an expression of our moral advancement and our philosophical advancement, our advancement in character, our growth as people. And whenever our technological progress outpaces our moral progress, that's when we get out of balance. That's where we start making mistakes. The worst sin of Star Trek is playing God.
Well, I think you're right that the technology you see in Star Trek is not, it's not technology for technology's sake. It's technology to solve a problem. It's technology to make the world better. The technology didn't invent itself. It had to come from creators, you know, who invented the technology. So, you know, just like in the Christian worldview, you get, you know, the creation kind of run amok. You know, you get a fallen creature that has violated the commands that God gave, leading to the whole Christian worldview. You know, in these episodes of Star Trek where you get technology out of control, like the Borg, that's a very interesting metaphor itself for the fallenness of mankind on a Christian worldview.
You're slipping right into some stuff I'm going to be saying.
We don't want to give away too much from the next book, but
no, that's fine. If you want to go there, that's fine. Or we can come back next year and do this, you know. But yeah, you're absolutely right, and I think that's one of the fundamental things to understand about Star Trek is it's not about science, it's about faith. It's not about technology, it's about the human heart. There's a great quote from David Gerald where he says, "The final frontier is not in space. The final frontier is the human soul." And space is where we go to find it, you know.
Yeah.
So, in other words, this journey out into space, you know, is the tool we use to further our journey inward, to further our journey as people, and I would say as people who are striving to become closer to the image of God in which they were created.
Kevin, I think if Gene Roddenberry had a message in Star Trek, it is that mankind is capable of so much more. And I relate that to really what I think is very much at the heart of the message of Jesus in the Gospels, and that is that a redeemed mankind is capable of so much more. And so I find a lot of harmony there, a lot of concourse between really what I think Gene Roddenberry was striving for in his vision of humanity in the future and really the heart of what I think Jesus was teaching in the first century to his followers, to his disciples, and that is that we can achieve much, much more than we even think is possible. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think you're bang on there. I think you're absolutely right that there is a certain parity between Roddenberry's worldview and the Christian worldview. Actually, if you look at his vision for the future of humankind, and you see a place without war, you see a place without disease, you see a place without racial boundaries, you see a place without national boundaries, you see a place without religion, you see all these, this human unity and yet this diversity and this peace. And it's very much what we talk about in the culmination of the gospel with the new heavens and the new earth, mm-hmm. when the rule and reign of Christ comes and the lion lies down with the lamb, you know?
You know, not to use too heavy of a term, but it's almost eschatological. I mean,
it is absolutely eschatological.
It has an end goal. It's teleological, yes. Right? There's a direction towards the evolution of mankind.
Absolutely. Indeed.
That more ideal state.
And I don't think that's too heavy a term at all. I think that's actually a precise term. And what I say about it is that Gene Roddenberry wanted the culmination of the gospel without the gospel, or rather with his own gospel, which was that humanity will pick itself up by its bootstraps and accomplish this on its own, which from my perspective, looking at the course of human history, I find that incredibly difficult to believe as a possibility. But you know, as Jesus said, with God, all things are possible. And so I won't say I don't doubt that. I doubt everything every day. But at my best, I don't doubt that that will ultimately be accomplished. Humankind makes it hard to believe some days, but
I think where you get some difference, though, is that on a Christian worldview, it's not that mankind is capable of sort of perfecting him or herself, right? And on the Christian worldview, it, you know, you need the activity of God the Creator, Jesus the Redeemer, as that perfecting impulse, the causation of that perfection. Whereas it seems like Gene Roddenberry is much more confident in mankind's ability to perfect him or herself without this external impulse.
Which I think is actually a great remedy to contemporary Christianity, because our view of how we improve is far too external. We have this concept that, okay, you get saved and all of a sudden the switch is going to get flipped inside of you and you're going to not sin anymore and you're going to be happy and, you know, all these things are going to happen. It's ridiculous.
As if you don't have to do any work, right?
Right. Exactly. It's not biblical. It's not realistic. And when people's lives don't turn out the way we promise, when we preach this false gospel, by the way, of this instantaneous better humanity, people feel horrible about themselves.
Yeah.
Their faith isn't real, that they aren't good enough, yada, yada. You know what? Christianity is not a faith where you've got to earn your way. So if you're sitting there feeling like you're not good enough, you haven't heard the gospel.
Well, I've often said, Kevin, I've 25 years in ministry, and I've often said that discipleship is a messy process.
Yes, absolutely. And I think Star Trek recognizes that. And what Star Trek does is it refocuses us to recognize that, yes, God does all of these things. And yes, God can do all these things very miraculously without our help. However, he has chosen to work through human beings. There's that old story of the man whose house is who's having a flood, you know, and the flood gets higher and higher and higher. And he's actually trapped up on the roof of his house. And he keeps praying, God, please deliver me. God, please deliver me. And this guy rows by in a boat and says, hey, can I help you out, buddy? And he says, no, you know, I'm God's going to save me. God's going to save me. And the guy rows on. And then the water keeps getting higher and another boat comes by, you know, the big water boat or whatever comes by and say, hey, can you come on, help, you know, we'll rescue you. He's like, no, God's going to save me. God's going to save me. Gets down to where he's on the little peak of his roof and the water's all around. And a helicopter comes and drops a ladder. Come on, grab on. No, God's going to save me. And then he drowns and dies. And then stands in front of God and says, and I don't understand this. I prayed and prayed. I was as faithful as I knew how. I trusted you above anybody else to save me. Why didn't you save me? He's like, I sent a rowboat. I sent a motorboat. I sent a helicopter. What were you going to, you know, when were you going to listen? So the idea that human agency is actually a part of the action of God is so important. And I think Star Trek can help us to redeem that idea, to see that. That's another reason I want us to see our humanity as a good thing, because the thing through which God has chosen to express himself, or through which God has chosen to do his work. And we fail at accomplishing those things all the time. And yet God in his grace and mercy continues to trust us with that job. So we better step up.
Now, Kevin, you mentioned earlier the Undiscovered Country Project, which I'm somewhat familiar with. And matter of fact, you're about to hit a very busy time of year. Spocktober is coming up right around the corner. Do you want to tell our listeners out there about the Undiscovered Country Project and what that is and what you do, how they might be able to connect with that?
Well, I'll tell you what, by way of talking about the Undiscovered Country Project, let me answer Zachary's earlier question, which we didn't get around to, and I'll tell you where the Undiscovered Country Project came from. I was, because you asked my relationship with Star Trek philosophy over time, and I started out as a Star Trek fan when the 30 years ago, when Next Generation premiered, and I got really, really into it. I got into the Next Generation, I got into the original crew movies, and I was all in for a long time, and I say in the book, my first step toward the gospel according to Star Trek was walking away from Star Trek. And that was in the later 90s when I was graduating high school and what have you. And there was just too much Star Trek on TV for me to catch up. This was pre-DVR and all that, you know. And so I just dropped it because I was just, you know, I got to where I was just going to the movies. And then eventually I saw Insurrection and then I questioned going to the movies. And then I never, I just didn't didn't watch any Star Trek for many years. And then I was in college, and I was on a scholarship that was provided by my wife's grandfather. He provided it to all his grandkids and several other students at my university. And I was just going to get a degree to hang on the wall, to get a better job in video production and film, and that was it. And then one day I went to my good friend, Dr. Noggle's Intro to Philosophy class. And after that first day in class, I went to my advisor immediately and said, how do I change my major? Because I had a whole new view. Zachary's really liking that. I had a whole new view of what education was for.
See, if I was your counselor, I would have said, don't do that. That's career suicide.
I'm glad you were my counselor. But no, he, that's how I ended up with an interdisciplinary degree in communication and philosophy, because, you know, I traded out all my communication electives and took Dr. Noggle's courses for the rest of my bachelor's and master's career, as many of them as I possibly could. And because it changed my whole view of what I was doing, that education wasn't about getting the degree to hang on the wall to get a better job, that education was about improving me as a human being, and that was an inherently spiritual process. And also that there was no such thing as this divide between the sacred and the secular. There was no such thing. One of the things that we quote in the Noggle world all the time is Abraham Kuyper, who says, there is not a square inch of creation over which Christ does not cry, mine. So the idea that God is at work everywhere, that everything belongs to him and everything is sacred, was totally revolutionary. And that's what allowed me to see Star Trek with new eyes. So I came back to Star Trek and I saw it in a new way. And I knew it was going to be a paper, and then I knew it was going to be a book. And then I started the Undiscovered Country Project, to get back to Mike's thing. I started the Undiscovered Country Project to lay a foundation for everything that I knew I was going to do from there on.
Kevin, I guess I want to dive in just a little bit deeper on the direction you were going there. I think I want to kind of understand what the initial spark was when you first realized that there's a problem to be solved. There's something that's not being talked about that it's important to talk about, when you first started to try to reconcile the tensions in your own worldview, and maybe what the evolution of that has been since. You know, what are some of those early connections that you found inside the Star Trek universe, whether it's Christ metaphors, whether it's certain ethical views? Is there anything sort of that doesn't fall into those two sort of easy categories of connections between Star Trek and Christian theology? And where are you today in terms of the discussion? Is there still a problem to solve? Do you feel like you've fleshed out a lot of these connections already, or do you still see that there's a problem to be worked on philosophically or theologically or even personally for you?
It's interesting because you use the language that you do regarding those things, because I don't perceive that I'm solving problems. I perceive myself as making discoveries. Because for me, it wasn't that I had this disparity or this disunity between my worldview and the Star Trek worldview and I had to reconcile it. It was rather that I loved Star Trek, but didn't know why. Then had my worldview conversion, as I call it, to see things in a new way, and then suddenly realized why I love Star Trek. And that was that it was echoing these great human questions and these great human longings that are at the core of what it means to be human, and therefore are at the core of the gospel. Because if the gospel is what we say it is, if it is the fulfillment and the completion of our humanity, then when we talk deeply about what it means to be human, we ought to find ourselves bumping up against the gospel. And I think Star Trek does that all the time.
So, Kevin, the first book in your series focuses on the original crew, the original series, and the original crew films, and even up into the Kelvin timeline. What were some of the surprising connections that you found? Is there anything that really, you know, a connection that you found between Star Trek and Christian theology, or Star Trek and your own worldview, that was illuminating when you discovered it? I think there's the obvious connections that we can talk about very easily, but what were the surprises for you?
Well, I'll tell you, the when you say surprise, the biggest surprise for me was Star Trek IV, because I had done stuff on Star Trek 2 and 3 talking about Spock as a Christ figure and everything, and I had done audio commentaries on those films, and we'd really gone through that in a lot of detail, and I was really happy with that. I was like, dude, that's awesome. And then one day I just got this really strong desire to watch Star Trek 2, and not for work, just to enjoy it, you know. And I was like, dude, I'm gonna watch Star Trek 2. I'm not gonna even take any notes. Well, I ended up taking some notes anyway, but I haven't watched Star Trek 2. Really enjoyed it, and then realized it was Palm Sunday. And I went, ah, of course, it's Palm Sunday. Of course I'd want to watch a Jesus movie. And so, and so then I was like, well, let's just make a thing of it. And the next day I watched Star Trek 3. And I was like, yay, you know, we've told the gospel in Star Trek, hurrah. Well, but then the Trekkie in me is like, hey, we're doing this for pleasure, man. We're not doing this to take notes. You need to watch Star Trek 4 to finish out the trilogy. And I was like, okay. And I was like, yeah, it's going to be the funny one with the whales and, you know, whatever, but that's cool. You know, it'll divert from the whole Spock as Jesus thing, but we'll get on with life. And then I watched Star Trek 4, and Spock was Jesus in Star Trek 4. And I had to, I mean, I had to stop the film. I was like, I can't handle the amazing things that are crushing into my brain right now, because it's just one of those. It's honestly so many times in this process, I have had honestly some of those sacred moments in my life where it's just been these realizations of things that I never saw before that I wouldn't have gone looking for, that just came to slap me in the face.
I don't want you to give away too much from inside your book, but I'm wondering if you can flesh that out a little bit for listeners. I think I know what you mean by that. Mm-hmm. And I think Mike knows what you mean by saying there's a connection there in Star Trek 4, but I'm wondering.
Star Trek 4 around here, by the way.
Oh, Kevin. Good.
Yeah, we tend to watch it down in Cetacean Ops with Lieutenant Commander Flipper.
Cetacean Ops.
It's movie night in Cetacean Ops.
But I think there are probably listeners out there that don't immediately know the reference you're trying to make and the connection. Can you spell it out a little bit without giving away too much from your
book? Well, you know, I, if you like what I'm saying, just check it out in the book, because there's more there, I promise. But, you know, so it's so easy to just say, well, you know, Star Trek 2... you know, Spock dies, Star Trek 3, he comes back, ta-da, Jesus. There's so much more stuff. There's even some biblical imagery in Star Trek 3 that I'm like, I have no evidence that anybody was thinking of this when they made this movie, but if that's not a biblical metaphor, I don't know what is. You know, just like coming to the empty tomb and there's his folded clothes and like there's two guards standing at the door where the seal mm-hmm. is broken. And, oh my gosh.
And arguably, you know, Kirk is the good shepherd that will sacrifice the good of the many to go after the one.
Oh, hey,
Star Trek. Yeah.
Hey, I'm going to say, yeah. I wish you'd said that earlier. I would have stolen it and put it in the book. What the heck?
Here's the thing for me, because again, in 25 years of ministry, I have been known to drop Star Trek illustrations in sermons, Star Wars, Seinfeld. Matter of fact, I got a nasty phone call one Sunday afternoon because I used a Seinfeld illustration in a sermon, and the congregation totally got it. I got the call from the senior pastor of the church who wasn't there, who was just appalled that I would invoke Seinfeld in a sermon. But here's the thing for me, I'm able to make these connections. And Solomon writes in Ecclesiastes chapter 3 that God has made everything beautiful in its time. And he goes on to say, and he has put eternity into our hearts. So inherently, the message of the gospel is something that resonates, I think, inside every living, breathing human being. And it comes out of us in the most unexpected places. And in no way do I think that, whether it be Gene Roddenberry or Dorothy Fontana, or no matter who it is, Brandon Braga, I don't think the writers of Star Trek intended these biblical or gospel references in any way, shape, or form. But the sheer fact that God has placed eternity in our hearts, we've been telling the same story over and over again for thousands of years. What are your thoughts on that, Kevin?
No, I completely agree, because and I want to get back to the Star Trek 4 thing too, but because I think it plays into that. But I completely agree that the reason it works both ways. There are these deep hungers in the human heart for which the gospel is association, and we are made for the gospel. We are made for God. Therefore, we have these deep hungers in the human heart. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's a sort of cyclical relationship. And so that need for these life-affirming things and for this exploration of these questions of meaning and purpose that we have all the time as human beings, and this need to know that the concept of redemption exists is so vital. This need to know that the concept of unconditional love exists is so important to us as human beings. We tell these stories that are reaching for these things. Mm-hmm. I completely agree with you there. It's absolutely true.
Kevin, I've got a follow-up question for you on that point. So one of the things that's happened in the 20th and now 21st century is what I would call the specter of relativism in any kind of worldview like that. So some of the concepts you're describing seem very entrenched, maybe not even necessarily in a Christian worldview, but I would call it generally Judeo-Christian or a Western worldview. In Star Trek, we see, humans, members of the Federation and Starfleet encountering alien races that have radically different ethics, radically different worldviews. I don't want to put you on the spot and say, what's your answer to this question? But what is generally your take on this idea of relativism as it relates to universal human urges? I think you can plausibly say there's a universal need in all of us for the things you described, whether that manifests itself religiously or theologically or not. I think most Christians would agree to this point that there's something universal that whether or not you're a believer of this particular worldview, you hunger for certain things and it's part of your human nature. But in Star Trek, we encounter radically different cultures and radically different worldviews and radically different ethics. So does that undermine the ability to say there is this universal need that Star Trek is appealing to?
I don't think so at all, because the reason we have all these radically different worldviews is because we're all trying to answer the same questions. We're just going about it in different ways and coming to different conclusions. And in terms of whether we explore that religiously or not, I would say we do explore it religiously, whether we acknowledge that or not. I talk in the book about the term homo religiosus, that is, mm-hmm. human beings are a naturally spiritual race. We naturally look for greater meaning in our lives. And so, and there's a song by Switchfoot even that says, I don't know it real well, but it says, your music is your religion, your politics is your religion, and lists all these things. It's all these things are your religion, are your religion, are your religion. And that's two different ways. Number one, if you don't have a religion, but you cling to these things are replacing a religion for you. Number two, if you do have a religion and you engage in these things, which you do because you're involved in human community, these things are how you live your religion. These things are how you live your faith, and they're not separate from that process. So all of us are engaged in the same spiritual process. It's just a matter of how we get there. When you talk about relativism, postmodernism, all this, I love those things. I think they're wonderful. And I think they're wonderful things for Christians to engage, because the fact of the matter is that postmodernism has wonderful and very true things to say about the nature of language and about the nature of meaning, how we make meaning, how we find meaning, all those things. They're very true. And I read a Christian writer one time who was talking, this was in the late 90s, early 2000s, so the specter, as you're saying, of postmodernism was being discussed quite a great deal. And he said, it's a good thing to talk about this postmodernism thing, but we dare not peer too far over the edge, lest we fall into the abyss, And I was thinking, oh, buddy, you don't know, but you're living in a postmodern world right now. You are breathing postmodern air. You are swimming in the postmodern pool. This is where we're at. And if you don't engage that, if you don't think about that critically, you're missing everything. You're missing the whole point. And I say that about a lot of things, but there is such a thing as relative ethics. There is such a thing as subjective ethics. There really are. And in fact, if you're not considering situational ethics, if you're not considering the situation and subjective ethics, if you're not considering the subject, you're not fully considering the ethical implications of your actions. You have to have those things. So yes, the project of modernity kind of crashed and burned, that did happen. Sorry. But, that doesn't mean that there isn't value in what's being said in a strongly relativistic, strongly subjectivist, strongly postmodern view, even if you would as a Christian, reject some of the sort of nihilism and naturalism that goes along with that. Okay, we can rescue good things out of that, and we can rescue good things out of a modern worldview as well. It's even though the project failed, it doesn't mean that it wasn't based on good observations and good ideas. So if you put all these things together, maybe we can come up with something better. And I go back to Hegel on this, that Hegelian dialectic of the thesis, the antithesis, and the synthesis. So yes. an idea gains traction for a really long time, and people get really committed to this ideology, and then it breaks down and falls apart. And so the antithesis rises as this new way of being. And then after the antithesis starts to show its cracks, then people start to create a synthesis of new ideas. This is how human ideas progress over time. And unfortunately, what's happened at this point, and this has to do again with our technological progress outpacing our moral progress or our philosophical progress, we're at a place right now where our culture is moving at such a pace, it's moving so quickly and in so many directions at once, that it's very difficult to have that sort of clear three-step process of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. And so what I find that we're doing, folks like me who are cultural commentators and public philosophers and theologians, are what I find that we're doing is that we're having to take all these little fragmented threads and just find places where we can make those syntheses.
I think you made a good case for the view that mankind fundamentally is a meaning seeker, right? You know, when these worldviews break down, when there are tensions, when you're in a time of personal crisis, almost no matter where you're at in life, what your station is, what your situation is, you're going to be hungering for meaning. And this is something I see Star Trek speaking to. I'm thinking mainly in the Star Trek films, from Star Trek 2 into 3 into 4. Captain Kirk is kind of having a crisis of meaning. You know, he's getting older. He's lost his captaincy. He's not sitting on the bridge of that ship anymore. And he's going, what is the meaning of all this? Especially on top of everything, he loses Spock. and he's having a crisis. And he has to recapture the meaning in some way. And whether or not you're religious or theological, have a certain worldview, you're going to be finding ways of injecting meaning into your life. You're going to be doing practices, injecting yourself into projects, forming connections with people or things or worldviews or whatnot. You're going to be finding meaning and piecing a worldview together for yourself, whether or not you're consciously doing that and calling it a worldview. We do have worldviews and we do hunger for meaning, and we do try to synthesize things together into a coherent whole.
Right. And actually, I think it's happening in the Kelvin timeline as well. I think it's very much. I see so much more character development, so much more meaning, and so much more philosophical stuff in the Kelvin timeline films than it seems like a lot of people do. In fact, Star Trek Beyond is the longest chapter in the book. It's yes. 2,000 words longer than any other chapter. And there's a lot of stuff that I can't wait to get to in the audio commentary to really flesh out more. I think particularly that, you know, the first film is about finding calling and destiny and all that. And the second film is about the fruitlessness of revenge and some other things. It's really muddled. It's kind of a mess. It's not a very good film. But we move on. And Star Trek Beyond is a really good film. And it's about, okay, we found our calling, right? We found our destiny. I'm not going to get into that. There's a whole thing about predestination and free will and all this stuff that even though all this chaos happens, we still end up where we're supposed to be. And what a revolution that is in Star Trek. Nothing's ever been done like that. But we found our calling, we found our destiny, you know, and we overcame an obstacle and whatever. But at the beginning of Star Trek Beyond, I mean, Kirk is just lost. He's lost, you know, and he says it's easy.
It's become episodic.
It's difficult. Yeah, he says it can be difficult to feel grounded when even the gravity is. Mm-hmm. It's one of the great lines in the history of Star Trek right there.
I love the scene when he opens up the closet and all he sees is this row of uniforms. They're all the same.
They're all exactly the same.
Yes, that's the episodic line. That's the episodic line. Things are beginning to feel, open the closet door, episodic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's, but it's great because, it's a similar process. It's a similar quest for meaning for Kirk and for Spock in these movies too. It's really fantastic.
I mean, is it too heavy-handed just to say that this is a type of crisis of faith for Captain Kirk, whether in Star Trek 2 or 3 or whether in Star Trek Beyond? Are we reading too much in there, I guess, is my concern.
Not at all, because, you know, you talk about faith, and I know you're probably saying that in sort of a traditionally thought of as religious sense, but faith is essential to who we are as human beings. and faith is essential to Star Trek. You know, I'm skipping ahead four books, but when Star Trek Enterprise came out, the whole idea of Enterprise was, you know, let's bring it down to the core of what Star Trek is. And everybody got really mad that they put a pop song over the opening titles, but they took that moment of showing the progress of, you know, the Enterprise, you know, the progress of our reaching out into space and saying, this is what we're here for. This is what we're about. And what song did they choose to go with that? I've got faith, faith of the heart, because that's what Star Trek is ultimately about. It's about faith. It's about the faith that we can go out and we can do this thing and we can find these things that we're searching for and that we can be better. So no, I don't think it's a leap at all. I think it's exactly, again, you keep doing this, Zachary. You keep thinking that you're overstating things, and you're actually being very, very accurate.
I think there's a danger in drawing hard lines in the sand. I think, you know, generally the fact that Star Trek is perceived as being humanistic and atheistic, kind of through and through, even when it touches on religion, it tends to do so in a skeptical way. There's a danger of just sort of saying, nope, we're reaching too far. We've crossed the line. We're reading too much in, and it's us coming through, and it's not Star Trek anymore.
And Star Trek is humanistic, but you know, you have talked about the fact that's the good part of it. That's what makes it relevant to a Christian worldview. But it does have a reputation for being atheistic, but it's not.
So one of the questions I have for you, Kevin, insofar as your first book in the series is about the original crew, what are the things that you find that are really unique to, I'm thinking of the original series in particular, but you know, if you want to delve into the movies or into the Kelvin timeline, where has Star Trek's approach or attitude towards religion changed and deviated over time? You know, what did we get in the 1960s that was really unique to that show? And how is that, I don't want to, of course, you're going to cover this in your second book on the Next Generation, but what is the evolution of that approach towards religion been? And what are the things that are just so unique to the times in the 1960s or to that original crew that is really different from anything else we see anywhere else in Star Trek?
I kind of think that in the 1960s, a lot of the social developments that were being sort of casually demonstrated on the bridge of the Enterprise that were so revolutionary for the time, by the 1980s, were taken for granted. So when we get to Next Generation, I think the confidence that's in that series, the idea that maybe we have arrived, that almost happens but doesn't quite, because we constantly have to keep saying no, we haven't arrived. Cue I need you. But that sort of almost more relaxed feeling. I mean, you look at the design of the bridge, it's open and wide, and actually it's the same size as the original crew bridge, but it looks more open and wide, and it's carpeted. You know, the ship is carpeted. We have a counselor. We have a play place for the kids. And the seats, if you look in the first season, particularly the seats at the con and helm, like they lean back almost too far. They're so casual, you know. I think that kind of comes to the idea that maybe all those things that we felt like we had to fight against in the 60s and the 80s, we had the idea that maybe we'd overcome those things. And of course, actually, today's world proves we haven't.
I recently watched the miniseries The Thornbirds from the 1980s. I don't know if anyone's seen this. If you haven't seen it, it's one of my favorite things that's ever been on television. Go see it. But basically, the setting is sort of a frontier Catholic parish out in the outback in Australia. And I'm sort of thinking, as you've described it, of the original series being sort of like literally out in the frontier, the final frontier, right? You know, some sort of frontier parish. You know, there's moral revolutions to make. There's moral discoveries. The moral high ground has not yet been discovered for society at large, you know, on these issues, whether it's racism or gender or whatnot, right? And in the 1980s, with Star Trek The Next Generation, it's a little bit more like being in a plush evangelical church. Right? You know, nice carpet inside the sanctuary and whatnot, right? So in the 1980s, have the revelations already been made and the general population has already been won over and, you know, the moral high ground has already been found and now we can enjoy the fruits of all of that? I just thought of this connection now. Is that a ridiculous connection? But it does seem like in the 1960s, it really is being out on the frontier of morality. In the 1980s, a lot of those revelations had already been made and accepted. Not by everyone, obviously. There's still battles to fight. There's still revelations to find. But a lot of the hard-fought battles of the 60s had already been won.
I'll tell you this, that calling the Enterprise an evangelical church would have driven Gene Roddenberry's.
Well, there's carpet on the Enterprise, right?
Yeah, there's actually this line in the book, and I quote it in my book, in the book Gene Roddenberry, The Last Conversation, by Yvonne Fern, where he says, "I can't believe we're comparing Star Trek to a religious ceremony. You're driving me crazy." I heard that ringing in my ears when you were saying it's like an evangelical church. But yeah, there is a certain sense of newness, of the kind of almost untested nature, which is probably why it was a little difficult to go back and recreate that in Enterprise. The sort of untested nature of what it is we're doing and how we're even organized. I mean, if you listen to the dialogue, the writers are still figuring out how a lot of this stuff works. And so even stuff like what's the Federation, you know, still hasn't really been sorted out yet. You know, so we're making this stuff up as we go as writers. And so therefore, yeah, we have that feeling that comes out in the scripts too. And it's also a bit philosophically too, because I think Star Trek was venturing into sort of dangerous territory at the time. You know, there was definitely the idea that we're going to address these social issues that it's not okay to address in public. Mm-hmm. But we're going to do it, as Gene said, you know, with purple people on another planet, you know, and if we do that, maybe we can squeak by. And we squeaked by rather loudly and rather smoothly. But yeah, Next Generation, you know, it's syndicated. Gene's got carte blanche creatively, and it's 100 years later or 75 years later, whatever it is. And so it's meant to be more established. It's meant to be more, not that we don't have conflicts, not that we don't have crises, not that we don't have chaos, you know, and new discoveries to make, but rather our sort of system of how we do things and what we're doing and our sense of self in that sense is in a certain sense stronger, or at least perhaps it is less. I don't want to go too far with this because I know I'm going to get into writing more of the book. I'm going to say, I was totally wrong about that. But but perhaps it is less in Next Generation that we have to keep sort of reaffirming and reminding ourselves of what we're doing. Whereas in the original series, you have Kirk's speech about, you know, risk is our business. That's why we're here. That's why we're aboard her. You know, that wonderful speech from Who Mourns for Adonais, where he's talking to the lieutenant and saying, how do you stand up against Apollo by remembering who and what you are, a bit of flesh and blood afloat in a universe without end. And the only thing that's truly yours is the rest of humanity. That's where our duty lies. I mean, those kinds of mission statements, you know, whereas in Next Generation, you're saying, well, yes, you know, when we wore uniforms like that, we were barbarians, but we've evolved beyond that, you know, and we're constantly trying to affirm that even though we're still on the journey, we have gained a whole lot. So there's a little bit more of that outright, we know who we are stuff in TNG.
Well, Kevin, I know you haven't finished book two yet on TNG, and so I don't want to pin you down too much because you might change your mind about any of these things. But how does that more relaxed setting that you get in Star Trek The Next Generation allowed Star Trek to make different or more nuanced different or more nuanced connections to Christian theology and the Christian worldview than you get in the 1960s in the original series. It seems like there has to be some sort of difference. The setting is different. The tone is different. The subject matter is often different. What has qualitatively changed about the types of connections that are made in The Next Generation as opposed to the original series? Again, given that you haven't finished the second book yet.
I would take it less from the kind of differences that we were just talking about and more from just the pragmatic side that the original series talks about religion and quotes the Bible a lot. Like, mm-hmm. You know, there, I have a, I have a, um, a chapter in the book called The Way to Eden, The Edenic Imagination of the Original Series, because there's so much. I mean, I think like Eden is the central myth, the central icon.
Yes.
The whole original series and all the original crew movies. There's even a callback to it in Star Trek VI. I mean, it's always there in every movie, in a lot of the episodes. And you don't have that in Next Generation. Next Generation tried a lot harder to avoid, not to avoid the subject of religion necessarily, not to avoid the subject of spirituality necessarily, but to avoid direct references like that. To the point that in Deep Space Nine, when Joseph Sisko quotes Paul, Ben kind of gives him a look and says, I've never known you to quote the Bible. You know, so it's just kind of this thing that I think Gene was very, very much adamant about the idea that religion would fall out of favor as humankind progressed. Well,
you made an interesting point in your book that the original series is almost obsessed with the idea of a false god. And it's not that Gene Roddenberry was bothered so much by religion, but he was bothered by charlatans and bad religion. And I mean, almost episode by episode by episode through the original series, there's one sort of false god or another. And that does bleed over into the Next Generation with characters like Q is a connection that comes to mind. But yeah, I mean, do you have anything to, you know, sort of share about this idea of a false god in the original series? Because that's where it seems to come up in Star Trek for me.
Yeah, I was really interested in that idea going in, because that's one of the things that, you know, one of the main things when you see people commenting on Facebook or you know, on Reddit or whatever, people will say, Gene Roddenberry was an atheist and he hated religion, and that's why in Star Trek we're constantly going out and debunking all these religions, because religion is a myth and a lie. And God isn't real, God doesn't exist. And there is a sense in which, and this gets into the Gene Roddenberry chapter a little bit, there is a sense in which Gene did not believe in God as a person. A personal God. He rejected traditional, what we would call monotheism.
It's almost like Spinoza with pantheism.
Right. I hesitate to call him a pantheist, because he locates the divine in human beings almost exclusively. He says all intelligent beings on this planet. I'm thinking, well, are you including dolphins in that? I'm not sure. You know, I would like to have quizzed him on that. You know, but he says all of us are a part of God. So he had a very pantheistic type theology, but it wasn't the rock is God, the tree is God. You know, it was you and I are God. I think he made a statement one time that made me think, well, because he said, you are a legitimate part of everything that is. So I wonder, does that mean, you know, the all? He talked about the all and all these different things. It's you have to kind of piece this stuff together. But his view of, but when you talk about false gods, I think his view of religion, you talk about, you know, well, it wasn't religion so much that he was against, it was charlatans and fakery and all that stuff. But I don't think he saw much in religion that he didn't think was charlatans and fakery. I don't think he saw much, he didn't have a very favorable view of religion. And that comes from and I don't want to denigrate, and he would not denigrate, the kind of Christianity that he grew up in. It was where he got his moral core, his moral foundation, was from his Baptist church and from his family, even though he rejected the theology. And he seemed to have an affinity for the teachings of Jesus, even though he rejected the idea that he was any more divine than Gene Roddenberry was, you know. But at the same time, when you look at what Star Trek is tearing down in these false religions, it's oppressive religion. It's manipulative religion. It's dehumanizing religion. I was talking to somebody on Facebook just, I think, yesterday, and he was saying, well, Christianity is dehumanizing, and Christianity is manipulative, you know, and Christianity is controlling, you know. And I had to say, I'm really sorry, and I'm really grieved that religion as we have known it has done those things and has told that story, but that's not really the true story of Christ. It's not the true Christian story. The fact of the matter is, in a lot of our religion, we're just being very bad at being Christians. And that's how we end up with a Gene Roddenberry, who would have probably been a really passionate Christian if he'd recognized that the gospel was everything he was looking for.
Kevin, earlier we were talking about Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, and you were going to make a connection to the gospel probably something from the book. Would you like to jump back in, dive back into that?
Oh, I'd love to. I love to dive into those oceanic waters to further your
That knowledge. Was a pun, by the way.
Come join us in Cetacean Ops.
What's that?
Come join us in Cetacean Ops.
Yes, I would love to. We're going to go to Cetacean Ops after this. We're going to hang out with Jillian. And, you know, everybody who wants to can have pizza and a Michelob, but, you know. but yeah, the thing about Star Trek IV, I was astonished because I was telling the story earlier how I'd gone through Star Trek II, Star Trek III, yada yada. I was really happy with it. I had viewed the two films to try to, you know, just enjoy the trilogy, and I said, well, I'm going to watch Star Trek IV for the fun of it. And then I think it was the moment in the very end of the film when they're standing before the UFP president. They're all coming down to receive their judgment, you know. And the president says, Captain Spock, you do not stand accused. And he says, I stand with my crewmates.
Mm-hmm.
And I just went, oh, my goodness. Because that was when I realized that Spock was still Jesus.
Yes.
Because Jesus does not stand accused. But he comes to stand with us and to advocate for us at the seat of judgment. So I started thinking about this thing that is happening in these movies, in this movie, and the idea that Spock is the driving force behind all of this. He figures out that it's whale song. He figures out which species it is. He figures out how to make the radiation collector thing. I've lost my technical terminology there for a minute. You know, he figures out the calculations for time warp, which can't possibly work, but whatever. You know, he figures all that stuff out, right? And it's all Spock's plan. And what is the plan? The plan is to come and come back to Earth. Earth is at its end. It's the end of all things. It's the end of Earth. It's the end of time as we know it. It is being unmade because the probe has come and the probe can't find what it's looking for. As when God comes to probe humankind and cannot find our righteousness, we cannot stand. And so what is missing? What is missing is the whales. Well, and so Spock is coming to restore that which was taken away by our sin. Our short-sightedness, as the UFP president calls it, where we have doomed ourselves by our actions,
mm-hmm. right?
And we have scarred creation, and we have misused what we have been made stewards of, and we have brought about our own destruction. And Spock is coming to restore that, and to make it like new, and to restore not only Kirk, the church, not only us, humankind, but all creation is made new. And if you take a look back at Star Trek II, okay, Khan is our villain in Star Trek II, and he is coming at Kirk at this point where he is dealing with mortality, he's dealing with death, he's dealing with age, he's dealing with guilt, and the sins of his past coming back to attack at him. And it mm-hmm. is that Spock saves him from. And Khan is the inverse of Kirk. And he is the sort of sinful version of Kirk. And who is Khan? Well, he's Ahab. Meyer goes to great lengths to have Khan quoting Ahab.
Mm-hmm.
And Kirk is the whale, you know. And Khan is what? Khan is a whale hunter. And in Star Trek IV, what's the sin of humankind? Hunting whales.
That's awesome. That's so awesome.
Spock has overcome our whale hunting nature and restored all of creation.
You know, I have often made the connection for Spock being a Christ character. In fact, one of the things that I really appreciated when I was able to first make the connection with you and with the Undiscovered Country Project is that for the first time, I really felt like I had another Christian that got what I was saying. Because you tell people, oh, Spock's kind of he's a type of Christ. And, you know, they're almost, you know, like they said to Paul, much learning hath made me mad. So to be able to make a connection like that, I'd never thought of that. That is incredible.
Can you see why I had to stop the movie?
I have a follow-up question for you about this.
Yes, sir. Yes, please.
I think Kevin, you mentioned something a second ago that caught my attention. It's just a little snippet of what you said, but I think it's an interesting thread. You mentioned that Gene Roddenberry wasn't necessarily atheistic, but maybe he had some sense that, you know, we're all divine in some sense. It's not God is out there. It's not pantheism. It's not that God is everywhere. It's somehow God is within. And Captain Kirk pretty much says as much in Star Trek V, I believe, you know, that God is somehow inside of us, right? He's not out there. He's in here. And in general, this is a connection I make to just sort of Christian theology in general. There's a tension between thinking of God as transcendent, you know, creating as separate from creation, apart from creation, you know, the creator of creation, and being immanent inside creation, in that God is omnipresent, God is everywhere, you know, these concepts that God is all around us, even though he's a creator and apart from this tension between these two concepts is not easy to reconcile. And you can almost see these concepts being toyed with in Star Trek V in particular, and maybe in Gene Roddenberry's own mind.
I don't know that he was toying with those concepts as much as he had rejected one and embraced the other. Mm-hmm. But I would say that in Christian history, what has always sort of been orthodoxy is balancing the paradox, is saying you don't say that Jesus was human to the exclusion of his divinity, but you don't say that Jesus was divine to the exclusion of his humanity. You know, so we don't say that that God is transcendent to the exclusion of his personal involvement with us. That's deism, right? But then we don't go where Roddenberry goes and make ourselves God, because God dwells within. You know, so it's constantly balancing those things, and I think that to me is where the best theology rests. It's in those mysterious places where we need both wings.
It raises this fundamental question. If there is any substantive notion to the concept of the divine, you'd have to kind of locate it somewhere. You know, in Star Trek, you can't help but avoid these spatial metaphors, right? Is it outside of the universe somewhere? Is it transcendent beyond the universe somewhere? Is it inside of us somewhere? Is it in nature somewhere, like Spinoza thought? Where is this divine spark? And if you're anything other than just an outright naturalist, you know, it's naturalism through and through, you have this question, well, where is it? How do we access it? What's our relationship to it? And you can see different Christian denominations and different episodes of Star Trek, I think, locating that divine spark in different locuses, different places.
Well, I think that the easiest and simplest Christian answer to is God out there, is God in here, is God over there, is God in the rock, is God in the tree, is yes. Yes, he's in all of those places. You know, omnipresent means omnipresent, all mm-hmm. present, everywhere, which means there is nothing that does not speak of him, that he's not involved in, that he's not part of.
And it seems like Star Trek's reverence for almost everything it encounters while you're out there exploring the universe on the Enterprise is consistent with that. You know, you find something to be treated reverently with every alien culture, every new planet you find, every star, every new phenomenon you're exploring. I think there's reverence through and through, you know, all throughout the Star Trek universe, almost everything that's encountered, unless it's absolutely morally repugnant in some way, is treated with a great deal of reverence in Star Trek.
That's absolutely true. And even certain things that we find morally repugnant, we will sometimes concede to, because it's not our place to interfere with other people and their belief systems, even if we strongly disagree with them, because we don't have that moral authority. And I think that's really important in Star Trek, and I think there's a finessing of that between the original series and the Next Generation. I think the original series were much more prone to assert our moral authority, and in Next Generation we're less prone to. And I think we're wiser in Next Generation than we are in the original series. We may be calling a spade in the original series, but sometimes calling a spade is not all there is to the process.
I think you just get a good dose of humility in the Next Generation, and that is sometimes lacking in the original series.
Yeah, and I do talk a bit, actually, even in this book, about the importance of humility in Star Trek. That balance, again, the balance between the pride in humankind, but also our humility. We've accomplished so much. We've done so much. We have so much to be proud of. And yet we have lots of things to not be proud of. We have lots of failings. We have lots left to learn.
One of the things I really appreciate, Kevin, as I've read through your manuscript, The Gospel According to Star Trek, the original crew, you use dialogue. I mean, you're taking dialogue right out of Star Trek, right out of the original series, and you're putting it there in the page to help make these connections. And I really appreciate that, because as I've said here on Metatrex many, many times, for me, it's all about the dialogue. And there's something that Christians and Star Trek fans, Christians who aren't Star Trek fans and Star Trek fans agree on. And that seems to be that Star Trek and Christianity have nothing in common, that Star Trek is godless. And I've found that not to be true. And certainly in your book, you make all kinds of connections that we don't even have time to get into. We just want to encourage our readers, if you've appreciated what you've heard here today, and certainly it's been candy for our ears, music to our ears, because you're talking about determinism, you're talking about free will, you've mentioned Heigl. I mean, this is music to our ears, Zachary, right?
Well, I should say, Kevin, too, this is really praise for you of what you've done in the book. I think whenever you rely on dialogue, there's a danger of cherry picking, taking certain lines out of context and using those to justify whatever point you're trying to make. I really want the readers to understand you've done a really excellent job of not just cherry picking dialogue and making sure you're taking those pieces of dialogue in context, making connections, in-universe connections that are more robust than just taking isolated pieces of dialogue out of context to justify the point you're trying to make. It's a much richer analysis than that. It's praiseworthy.
So, Kevin, to my question, and all of that, what do you hope that readers will take away from reading The Gospel According to Star Trek?
Yeah. Well, there are lots of different things, and it depends on who the reader is. but I think if I can communicate some piece of the transformative things that I've discovered in my life, the transformative things that helped me to see Star Trek in a new way, and all the things that Star Trek has helped me to continue to discover, whether you're looking at that as being able to read a book that maybe you don't agree with philosophically or theologically, and yet appreciate the point of view of another person who's interested in the same things you're interested in, that in itself is an enormously beneficial human exercise. And if you love Star Trek and you love thinking about what it means to be human, a great way to improve yourself as a human being is to listen to people who disagree with you and get into their world and look at things from their point of view. And on top of that, for my Christian readers especially, I want them to recognize the sacredness of everything, the omnipresence of God. And I want them to see that God is present in our humanity, and that our humanity is not something to be ashamed of. It's not something to set aside. The world is good. The world is fallen. And the world can be and will be redeemed. And that concept is so fundamental to who we are and the story that we're called to tell in our world. If you get nothing else from the book, I hope that Christians can learn to be better Christians and better humans through Star Trek. I hope non-Christians can learn to be better humans through Star Trek. I hope all of us can see that the things that we love in this life have something to teach us about who we are and why we're here.
So The Gospel According to Star Trek has gotten really great reviews, lots of praise. Even our good friend Larry Nemechek here on Trek FM on the network had some wonderful things to say about the book, Barbara Luna, among others. Can you tell our listeners where they might be able to find this book if they want to? We certainly want them to go out and purchase a copy and give it a read. Where can it be found?
It's available everywhere in Amazon and Barnes & Noble. You can go on those websites to find them. You can go on my website, kevincnees.com. You can go to gospelaccordingtostartrek.com. You can go to Whiffenstock website, Whiffenstock Publishers website. There are all kinds of places to get it in where fine books are sold. There's a paperback and a hardcover edition. And of course, when I go out and speak and when I do author events and things like that, if you have me come out and speak to your church or your school or your event or whatever, I will bring books with me and you'll be able to buy them and get them signed right there in person. So all kinds of ways to get it.
Fantastic. And how about you? If our listeners want to connect with you, how can they connect with you? Where can they find you on the interwebs?
Well, the website, kevinsinise.com, also Facebook. There's the Kevin Sinise author speaker page. There's the Undiscovered Country Project page. There's undiscoveredcountryproject.com. I'm on Twitter as well. And you can also on the website, you can even sign up for my email mailing list and get news that you can use that way.
And about Spocktober coming up right around the corner.
Yeah, Spocktober. Do you want me to talk about that real
quick? Yeah, get a plug in there for Spocktober.
So when I started the Undiscovered Country Project, it was 2011. And October of 2011 was when Leonard Nimoy announced his retirement from conventions, which was just following the Dallas Comic Con, where I had missed seeing Leonard and thought, oh, well, I'll see him another time. And then in that October, he announced his retirement. And I said, oh, well, I guess I'll never see him. And I was really, I was kind of saddened by it, but I wanted to do something to honor him and to respect that moment, you know? And so I declared that October the first Spocktober, because I thought, why isn't anybody doing this? Spocktober, it's perfect.
It's perfect.
I wish no one thought of that before.
I know. And so I did, a lot of guest posts for the blog. That's been a lot of the things that we've done. We've also done, we did a thing where we had a giveaway. We've had giveaways a couple of years where Steve Neal, who is the visual effects and makeup artist who sculpted Spock's ears for Star Trek The Motion Picture, he has the molds, the original molds that he used for that film that he sculpted, and he makes new ears off those molds. And he has contributed every year one or two pairs of ears for us to give away. The very first year, actually, one of the requirements for that was trying to get Leonard Nimoy to tweet with the word Spocktober in his tweet, which he did. And so, oh, that was really cool. This year I'm kind of still formulating exactly what it's going to look like, but I've got the blog back up again. And so we'll probably have some guest blog posts. We actually produced a book out of all of the Spocktober guest posts from 2011 through 2014. I compiled this book called Spockology. And I'd put it together, and I was fiddling with it, trying to get it right, because I did everything on it. I did the layout and the design, I did the cover and everything, because I published it through Amazon CreateSpace. And then Leonard died. And I said, oh, we've got to do more with this. And so I brought in some more contributors and tried to give it more of a do even more to sort of honor Leonard's memory there, and got some great, wonderful posts. Steve Neal is in there telling his story of getting to make those ears for the first time and Leonard Nimoy and all that. That's marvelous. We've got a piece in there called How Leonard Nimoy Saved My Life. It was a remarkable, very candid piece from a person who I'd interviewed before for the book. And we've got Rabbi Yonason Gershom in there doing a Spock and Jews in the 1960s. We've got stuff that's personal. We've got stuff that's nerdy. We've got something that's theological, philosophical, all kinds of stuff in there. And that's what happens in Spocktober too. When I do those guest blog posts, I try to pull from a lot of different angles and just celebrate Spock. And then this year we did a thing called Spocktoberfest, where Steve Neal was our special guest, and I got contributors from the book together, and we had a Google Hangout session. It's on my YouTube channel, which is another way people get in touch with me. UC Project is the YouTube channel, and that's archived on there. So we'll probably do another one of those this year. And of course there'll be tie-ins with the Gospel according to Star Trek, the original producer.
Kevin, as you were describing what you hope readers take away from your book, it occurs to me that, almost every Star Trek fan has a deep, intimate relationship with the conversion power of Star Trek. If you ask almost any Star Trek fan, what has Star Trek meant to your life? It's very much like a religious conversion experience. It has been life-changing. It's had some profound impact on their life. That sounds to me like very much like what you'd hear from someone who is describing a religious experience or a religious conversion experience.
Absolutely. Yes. And there's a good reason for that. You know, and the reason is that it's helping us realize these very important things about what it means to be human that are tied to that same destiny that we're seeking after when we have a religious conversion. And so I want people to recognize that the reason they're drawn to Star Trek is those same deep things that drive us all. And that's not separate. That's not different. No, we don't have to look at it and say, oh, I can't be a Christian or whatever, or I can't love Star Trek because I'm a Christian, because I don't want Star Trek to become my religion, or Star Trek is my religion, therefore I can't find out what's going on with the gospel. But rather that, Star Trek is your religion. If whether you're a Christian or not, if this is part of the development of your soul, and yeah, it's part of your religion. I was talking with a guy called John Michael Talbot for a journal that I've written for. He's the most popular Catholic musician in the world, and a guy that I've listened to for many, many years. And I talked to him, and he was saying that religion and spirituality, I used this image earlier in the interview, actually, religion and spirituality are like two wings of a bird. You can't have one without the other. You know, the religion is not necessarily the things that we think of when we think of religion. Religion is just whatever you do to explore and express that spirituality. And he said, even if you're a Quaker and your order of worship is you have no order of worship.
A great many Star Trek viewers watch Star Trek religiously. I mean, this is the reason we talk about it in these terms. Like, it's for me personally, regularly, I will watch an episode or two of Star Trek from one of my favorite series. Oftentimes it's Voyager because I find it very relaxing and peaceful for some reason. But it's very much like a communion experience where it's a dose of daily bread. You know, watching Star Trek does something to my soul that is very much religious in nature. You know, again, not necessarily even in Christian terms. There's a religious component to it that has an effect on me at a very deep, profound level that is somewhat, it's at least spiritual, if not religious in nature.
Absolutely. And if, as a Christian, I can look at that process developing in my life and I can say, hold on, this doesn't have to be something that's separate from my faith, that's separate from my Christianity, that's separate, you know, that my Christian worship is over here in church and then my Star Trek worship is here in Star Trek. What am I doing? I can't worship Star Trek, you know.
that's overrated. Yeah,
right. But rather see that there's a reason this is feeding my soul, and that maybe God is here, you know, maybe God is actually at work telling his story through our human endeavors, especially through our creative efforts. And even when we're unaware,
I think this is something I myself don't pay attention to. I don't analyze this very much. Most Star Trek fans probably don't pay attention to this very much. But what is that deep down, deep set need that religious Star Trek viewing is trying to fill for you? And the answer will vary, I think, from person to person. I think there's something universal about human nature there, but there's probably, you know, each person will have some unique situation that it speaks to.
Yeah, I think the only way you can really address that broadly and accurately at the same time is to say that it's about our longing for connection with something that is greater than ourselves and meaning and purpose and who and what we are as human beings. And not just that, but hope. I think hope is maybe the most important thing that Star Trek and many, many of the stories that we tell give us.
Yes.
Paul says these three remain: faith, hope, and love, but the greatest of these is love. And I don't want to disagree with Paul, but sometimes I feel like if we don't have hope, we even lose our capacity to love.
Indeed.
The best way we can show love is to give hope to someone else. So I think Star Trek, if we're going to distill it in a very broad sense, that's it. But then I think philosophically, I would take from the very front of my book the words that David Gerald gave me in an email he was very kind to send when he did not, you know, when he declined to be involved with the book. But he said, but I will tell you this. He says, that is the core philosophy of Star Trek, stripped of everything else, is love one another. I think Jesus may have said something about that too. And yes. I couldn't have asked for a better encapsulation of so much of what I'm trying to say from a better voice than David Gerald, who I have eternal respect for and love, because it's just, that's it.
Indeed. Well, Kevin C. Neese, founder of the Undiscovered Country Project, author of The Gospel According to Star Trek, The Original Crew, available everywhere you get your fine books. It has been a pleasure having you aboard the Starship Theseus. We hope you'll come and join us again.
I'd love to, and it has been an absolute pleasure for me as well, and an honor, and I appreciate you greatly, both of you co-captains.
All right, well, thank you so much for joining us. Transporter Chief, energize.
Well, Mike, that was so much fun talking with Kevin C. Neese about his new book, The Gospel According to Star Trek, The Original Crew, and in general, just talking about Star Trek and theology and Star Trek and religion. I think this is one of these conversations where I always worry that it's not going to appeal to every listener, because not everyone has that worldview, not everyone has that belief system, not everyone's a Christian. But I think one of the most productive things you can do as a human being is to entertain ideas that are not your own and listen to each other with tolerance and respect, and try to turn those conversations into something productive. Find those connections between your worldview and their worldview, between their ideas and your ideas, considering the things that they have to say that you don't believe. And regardless of what your worldview is and what your beliefs are, I hope that we turned this discussion into something genuinely productive. If you're a Christian believer, I think you'll be amazed at the plethora of connections between your own beliefs and Star Trek are. If you're not a Christian believer, I hope that you look at Star Trek with sort of fresh eyes, that you see the universal appeal of Star Trek and its quest for meaning, and how that connects to other belief systems that are not your own. I think in general, that's always a productive conversation to have. And I think we did a great job diving into some of the details of Star Trek and religion here with Kevin today.
Indeed, I agree. We mentioned several times Larry Nemechek's endorsement of the book. And I just wanted to share this. This is Larry, and I can almost hear him saying this as I read it on the page. But I want to just read briefly a piece of Larry's endorsement, because what you said segues right into something that Larry says here about Kevin C. Neese's book, The Gospel According to Star Trek. Larry says, "Don't be scared off by the title, Trek fans, whether Christian, pagan, atheist, or any other corner of the global higher power scale. You'll find plenty of new insights into the human adventure amid the dots Kevin C. Neese connects in The Gospel According to Star Trek, The Original Crew. Kevin looks at Star Trek's love-hate relationship with paradises, god things, baby steps humanity, alien deities, and even the wacky implications of the animated series, and finds something to intrigue everyone." I think that really says it all. Zachary, I think there's something in there for everyone, whether or not they hold to the Christian worldview. I think there's something in there for everybody.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I read the manuscript a couple of days ago, and I share that assessment wholeheartedly. You know, I myself find connections that I find interesting for my own beliefs and faith. But I think regardless of what your beliefs are, regardless of what your faith is, even if you have no faith in any particular belief system, you will find some, you will learn something about Star Trek and learn something about yourself from reading this book.
And something about philosophy, because something that, again, as I've been reading Kevin's manuscript, you know, I find him very well-rounded philosophically.
Yeah, I think you're right about that, Mike. I think the danger when you're having a discussion about Star Trek and a particular religion is that you can get tunnel vision. You can always focus on your own worldview to the exclusion of others, and you can cherry pick your evidence, and it's very easy to kind of make a false case for whatever point you're trying to make. And I meant it when I praised Kevin for trying to avoid the trappings of those kinds of discussions. He's very conscious that he's of what perspective he's coming from. He's very conscious of the richness of the Star Trek universe and its competing views and its competing pieces of evidence. He's conscious of the implications of what he has to say. He's conscious of the objections to his own standpoint. So it's a very conscious and aware book. And because of that, it's philosophically rich, and it's it makes an attempt to be generous, even self-critical, I would say, at certain points. So if you're worried at all that the book is coming too much from a particular standpoint, I encourage you to give the book a try, and you'll see that that's not the case. But this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
You know, Pushing Daisies and Hannibal are two very different shows, but they both have a very strong visual look and a very strong storytelling style and a point of view. And one is quirky, and one is darkly quirky, and one is whimsically quirky.
Literary Treks.
She just does such amazing things with these characters, and it just consistently blows me away how invested I am in Chakotay's life decisions. I never ever thought that I would care two whits about what Chakotay does with his life, but I'm really invested here. You know, I really care about the decisions he's making and what's going to become of him in the future.
The 602 Club.
But now by the third one, you've got this really difficult task of, like every sequel has, you've got to be the same but different. And you've got to build on the success of that character that has been so cemented now by two movies. So the little things that started to show up in the first two movies, the quips, the cool clothes, all of this stuff is exponentially blown up onto a much, much bigger scale in this movie.
Saturday Morning Trek.
And all these things just brought in more and more people who thought they were alone, and they found each other, and they made their clubs, and then they made conventions. And that's what the 70s were about, was getting Star Trek back and finding each other.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the shows as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network through Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all of the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats in our content development team, and many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbital will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form on Trek FM's website. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
You can also leave us a voicemail, look in the sidebar on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, you can find us under the handle @trekfm.
You can also find us on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/trekfm. While you're there, check out the Babel Conference. That's the Babel Conference. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We also invite you to leave a rating and a review of MetaTreks in iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show, and it's one of the best things you can do to help other listeners find the show. Well, Mike, when you're not being resurrected in a Christ-like or a Spock-like manner, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network these days?
Well, Zachary, they can find me on Facebook. That's where I'm most active, certainly around the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is @cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. And Zachary, when you're not reading The Gospel According to Star Trek, the original crew, down in Cetacean Ops, where can our listeners find you around the interwebs and around Trek FM?
Well, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me, you can find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. And you can also find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, @ZacharyFruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, and Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, the founder and publisher of Trek.fm, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Ken Tripp, our art director, Aaron Harvey, and our production manager, Richard Marquez. We'd like to give a special thank you and a shout out to our two associate producers for Metatrex. We'd like to thank Patrick Devlin. You can find Patrick under the Twitter handle at MagicDrop5. And we'd like to thank Kay Elizabeth Janeway, and you can find her under the Twitter handle at ChocoWeeble. We really want to thank you for your support of Metatrex and for Trek FM in general. Well, everyone, thanks for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.